If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
A heavy rain blanketed the streets of Seoul. At the Seoul Metropolitan Police Agency, reporters clustered under umbrellas. Flashbulbs fired in rapid bursts as a man, flanked by officers, was escorted down the corridor. He was barefoot, expressionless, dressed in a yellow raincoat, thin, plastic, standard issue. No one yet understood the full scale of what he had done. The press knew only that he was a suspect in a serious case. But within days, South Korea would learn that this man, Yoo Young-chul, was responsible for a killing spree that had left at least 20 people dead. Among them were respected elderly couples and women working on society's margins. All had been targeted with the same brutal intent. Most had died by a hammer. Some had been mutilated. Others, Yoo would later claim, were partially cannibalized. The man the media dubbed the Raincoat Killer had moved silently among them for nearly a year. He had stalked the wealthy and exploited the vulnerable. He told police he had planned to kill 100 people, and that he was disappointed that he was interrupted before he could finish. You are listening to The Evidence Locker. Thanks for listening to our podcast. For an ad-free experience, join us on Patreon, starting at just $2 a month, with 25% of proceeds supporting the Doe Network, helping to bring closure to international cold cases. Our episodes cover true crimes involving real people, and some content may be graphic in nature. Listener discretion is advised. We produce each episode with the utmost respect for the victims, their families, and loved ones. In early 2003, the capital city of Seoul was vibrant and thriving. With its booming economy and global ambitions, South Korea projected stability and modernity. But behind the closed doors of some of its most exclusive neighborhoods, something far more sinister was unfolding. On September 24, 2003, emergency responders were called to a home in the Sinsadong district. Inside, they found the bodies of a 72-year-old university professor and his wife. Both had been beaten to death in their living room. The scene was shocking in its brutality. Blood had pooled across the floor. The professor had suffered severe cranial trauma. No valuables appeared to be missing, and also, there was no forced entry. This was a violent and tragic murder, but investigators initially treated the case as an isolated incident. Then, on October 9th, another couple was found, this time in Apgujeongdong. The male victim, in his late 60s, was a retired business executive. His wife, 63, had once been a school administrator. Both were bludgeoned in their bedroom. Again, no sign of forced entry, and nothing of major value taken. And just 6 weeks later, in November 2003, another double homicide occurred, this time in Bangbaedong. The victims, both in their early 70s, had been well known in their community. Neighbors described them as quiet, friendly, and deeply rooted in the neighborhood. They, too, were found bludgeoned. The door had been opened for the killer. Three double homicides, all involving older, affluent couples, all taking place within the span of a few months in the fall of 2003. And all without any clear motive. It was time for police from different jurisdictions to compare notes. All of them concluded that the killer's methods were startlingly consistent. Forceful blunt trauma, always to the head, inflicted with overwhelming strength and apparent speed. Forensic teams suspected the murder weapon was a hammer, though no tool had been recovered at any of the scenes. He had left behind no fingerprints, but at two of the scenes, forensic investigators found faint shoe prints, and they matched. The victims all shared similar profiles, retired professionals, quiet, respected. They lived in detached homes with privacy, residences that, in retrospect, may have made them more vulnerable. Police theorized that the attacker had posed as a repair worker or delivery man to gain access. By the end of November 2003, there had been four brutal homicides throughout Seoul. The victims were all found in their homes, bludgeoned to death with no signs of struggle or robbery. The Seoul Metropolitan Police formed a special task force. While South Korea had seen serial killers before, they were rare. The idea that one could be targeting people across social classes, killing them with such calculated brutality, was difficult to accept. Investigators hesitated to link the cases publicly, but internally it was clear. There was a pattern. Someone was stalking the capital's older, wealthier citizens. No matter how hard they tried to deny it, however, before long, the press began reporting on a possible serial offender. And then, as suddenly as they started, the killing stopped. Between late November 2003 and early 2004, there were no new elderly victims, no fresh scenes, no leads. The task force continued its work, but the trail was growing cold. Investigators wondered whether the killer had moved on, or perhaps died. Others speculated that he had been arrested for an unrelated offense. But in December, reports began to surface from an entirely different part of the city, not from Seoul's affluent districts, but from its underbelly. On December 18, 2003, a 27-year-old woman working for a phone-based escort service was reported missing. Her colleague said she had gone to meet a client in Mapo-gu and never returned. On December 24th, a similar report. Another woman, same occupation, same district, same method. A call to arrange a meeting, followed by complete silence. By January 2004, four women had disappeared in the same area under nearly identical circumstances. The victims worked independently, often without formal employment records. Many lived alone. Police were slow to connect the cases, and each one was treated initially as an individual disappearance. But within weeks, a few officers noticed the pattern. By the end of February 2004, five women, all between the ages of 21 and 34, were missing. All had taken client calls through payphone services or personal ads. Most had arranged to meet their clients in or near Mapo, Seodaemun, and Yongsan districts, and none of them were ever heard from again. On March 16, 2004, the body of a young woman was found near the edge of Bukansan National Park. She had been wrapped in a blanket and buried in a shallow grave. Cause of death? Blunt force trauma to the head. Her identity was later confirmed through dental records. She was 25 years old and had been reported missing in January. Soon after, more remains were discovered in wooded areas near Mount Gwanak and the Namyangju outskirts. Some were buried, others had been left exposed. At least one victim had suffered post-mortem mutilation. The police were no longer dealing with isolated incidents, and quietly, behind the scenes, the original task force investigating the murders of elderly couples began to share information with the detectives now working on these new cases. There was overlap. A growing belief took hold. What if it wasn't two killers? What if it was one? One man. Two victim types, same city, same weapon, and the same absence of clues.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
By March 2004, detectives from multiple units were coming to the same chilling conclusion. The unsolved murders of Seoul's elderly couples and the disappearances of young women working in the sex industry were likely connected. Two populations at opposite ends of the social spectrum. One common thread: an invisible killer. A joint task force was formed, bringing together detectives from violent crimes, forensics, and vice. The profile they were building was quite disturbing. The killer appeared to be intelligent, mobile, and adaptive. He had a working knowledge of the city's geography, favoring isolated homes in wealthy neighborhoods and unregulated motel rooms in more transient districts. He avoided surveillance. He didn't stay in one district. He didn't repeat the same routine. And then there was the weapon. In almost every case, the victims had suffered blunt force trauma, usually to the head. Forensic experts confirmed that the injuries were consistent with blows from a small, dense object, possibly a claw hammer. The wounds were deep, crushing, and precise. In most cases, the fatal strikes were delivered quickly and with overwhelming force. Some victims showed signs of overkill. The killer continued beating them, even after they had perished. What baffled investigators further was the lack of any forensic evidence. No usable fingerprints, no hair or fiber. Any trace DNA had been degraded beyond usefulness. The killer, it seemed, was meticulous. For every body found, there were more questions. And then another name appeared. In April 2004, officers in the Mapo district were alerted to the disappearance of a 26-year-old woman who had been working as an escort. Her friend, also in the sex trade, reported her missing after she failed to return from a late-night client appointment. According to phone records, the missing woman had received a call from a public payphone. The client had arranged to meet her at a motel near Yeomnidong. She was last seen entering the building shortly before midnight. The next morning, hotel staff found nothing out of the ordinary. No noise complaints, no disturbance. Her name was not registered, but the woman had vanished. Detectives traced the call to a payphone near Gongdeok Station. There were no nearby CCTV cameras. The client had used a false name. The motel's CCTV system was out of order. Once again, the trail was cold. That case joined a growing file of disappearances linked to escort services contacted via payphones. Low-tech, untraceable, and impersonal. Police knew they had a pattern, but they still didn't have a clue who the assailant could be. The pattern of disappearances continued through the spring and early summer of 2004. More women vanished under identical circumstances. All had been contacted through payphones by clients using false names. All had arranged to meet in motels or private locations. All disappeared without a trace. In mid-April, a burned van was found parked on the side of a service road in the Yeongdeungpo district. Inside, firefighters discovered the body of a man, hands removed, face disfigured by fire. His identity was confirmed through dental records, a 44-year-old street vendor named An Jae-sun. Though not one of the killer's typical victims, investigators noted one crucial similarity. An had died from blunt force trauma to the head. Before the van was torched, he had been restrained and beaten. No robbery, no clear motive. Detectives began to believe that the killer may have stepped outside his previous pattern, perhaps as a response to a perceived slight. Or maybe the patterns weren't as consistent as they once thought. Perhaps this individual didn't have one victim type, but many. Public confidence in the investigation began to falter. The press criticized police for failing to alert citizens. Theories circulated in online forums. Neighborhoods whispered about strangers in the alleyways, women walking home alone, deliverymen who didn't quite look right. The Seoul Metropolitan Police increased patrols. Still, the attacks continued. In the end, it wasn't forensic science or police strategy that led to the killer's capture. It was the persistence of a man in the adult services industry. In July 2004, a massage parlor owner in Seoul noticed something alarming. Two of his employees had recently gone missing, both of them after arranging calls with the same client. Then, he received a call from his missing employee's phone number. On the line was a man who wanted to arrange an escort. The parlor owner did not alert the caller, but brought his concerns to local police. The parlor owner then returned the call, posing as a sex worker, and arranging a meeting. The client agreed. On July 15, 2004, the massage parlor owner, along with two colleagues, waited in the Sodemun district, with police officers keeping a close eye. When the man arrived, they confronted him. A brief struggle ensued, and he attempted to flee. It took five officers to restrain him as he violently resisted the arrest. At the Sodemun police station, detectives began questioning the man. His answers were vague. He offered no identification and refused to name the women whose items were found on him. When pressed further, he claimed ignorance. He'd found the items, he said. He had no idea where the women were. Investigators didn't believe him. Inside his apartment, police discovered further evidence, clothing and belongings linked to several missing women, and traces of blood in the bathroom, later confirmed to be human. On his phone were numbers that matched several open case files. He had used multiple aliases, rotated phones, and frequented different motel districts. Still at this point, investigators did not fully grasp the scale of his crimes. Then, less than 24 hours after his arrest, he vanished. On the morning of July 16th, while being transferred to a holding area, the suspect suddenly collapsed, feigning a seizure. As officers scrambled for assistance, he bolted, racing through the hallway and out into the parking lot. He was barefoot, still wearing the same clothes. Witnesses later recalled the scene, a blur of movement, shouts, sirens. For hours, the city was thrown into a state of emergency. Roadblocks were set up. Officers swept nearby subway stations. Commuters were warned to avoid the Sodemun area. 12 hours later, the suspect was located near Sodemun Station, hiding in a stairwell, exhausted and disoriented. He was rearrested without incident. This time, extra precautions were taken, and fortunately, there would not be a second escape. Back in custody, and now under intense pressure, the man's demeanor shifted. He became quiet, compliant. Over the next few days, he began to speak. First, in vague statements, then, in unsettling detail. He had, he admitted, committed multiple murders. He described the elderly couples, how he had watched their routines, approached their homes during delivery hours. He told police about the women, how he contacted them, what he said to gain their trust, and what he did once they arrived. He spoke plainly, without remorse. Investigators began connecting his confessions to the files already on their desks. The victims, the scenes, the gaps in the timeline, every piece fit. The man they had in custody was, without a doubt, their killer. His name was Yoo Young-chul. In the interrogation room, Yoo spoke calmly and without emotion. He confessed to 21 murders, though investigators could only verify 20 with physical evidence. His confessions were chilling in their detail. How he selected his victims, how he gained access to their homes or lured them to motels, and how he killed. He described elderly couples as parasites, who had benefited from a system that had excluded people like him. He said women, especially those in sex work, were dirty and deserved to die. These were not the ramblings of a man in psychosis. His thoughts were coherent, cold, rational, at least within the confines of his own twisted worldview. But to understand how Yoo Young-chul became South Korea's most notorious killer, investigators had to go back where it all began. Yoo was born on April 18, 1970, in the rural county of Gocheng, in North Jeolla province. His parents separated right after his birth, and he, along with his siblings, were raised by their grandmother for a few years before their father took them to Seoul, settling in Mapo District, a neighborhood where working-class apartment blocks stood in the shadow of the city's growing, shiny wealth. His father struggled financially, and the family's hardship was a source of constant stress. At school, Yu was often ridiculed. He wore secondhand clothes and never brought lunch. Teachers considered him quiet and unremarkable, but classmates remembered his resentment towards students from wealthier families. He later described his childhood as humiliating when defined by exclusion. Despite his harsh and challenging circumstances, Yu had an appreciation for the finer things and showed early interest in art and music. He played guitar, painted, and even spoke of wanting to become a cartoonist. But these aspirations faded quickly. By his late teens, he was in and out of juvenile detention for theft. From 1988 onward, Yu began building a lengthy criminal record, which included burglary, robbery, fraud, and identity theft. His criminal activities escalated over the years, showing a pattern of increasingly serious offenses. In 2000, he was convicted of sexually assaulting a 15-year-old girl and sentenced to 5 years in prison. He was released in September 2003 after serving just 3 years of his sentence. It was during that prison sentence that something changed. While incarcerated, Yu began reading obsessively about other serial killers. He was particularly drawn to the case of Jung Do-young, a South Korean murderer who had targeted the wealthy between 1999 and 2000. Yu reportedly studied his methods and saw murder not as a last resort, but as a strategy, one that could fulfill both his desire for control and his deep, festering hatred of society. He began to develop a personal philosophy. He believed that the rich had cheated their way to the top, that women, especially sex workers, were responsible for moral decay. The killing was not a crime, but a form of punishment. When he was released from prison in 2003 after serving just 3 years, he didn't return to crime out of desperation. He returned with a plan.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key, and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Following his release, Yu was reported to have purchased weapons and tested his crimes on dogs before committing his first murder on September 24, 2003. In his confessions, Yu laid out his crimes in clinical terms. He said he chose elderly couples because they lived in isolated homes and offered minimal resistance. He observed their habits for days, what time they took walks, when deliveries arrived, how often they had visitors. Then he'd knock on their doors, pretending to be a repairman or someone looking for work. Once inside, he attacked immediately. He used a hammer because it was easy to acquire and carry. He didn't just kill, he struck multiple times, long after his victims had died. For Yu, the act was both symbolic and deeply personal. The hammer, he claimed, represented the working class. In his mind, it was poetic to use it against the people he blamed for his suffering. He then moved on to sex workers in late 2003 and early 2004. Yu later said he viewed them as corrupt and believed he was cleaning up society. With the sex worker killings, he changed his tactics, but not his motive. He would call them using payphones, luring them to motels or to his apartment in Mapo. There, he would attack them in the bathroom, a confined space that gave him total control. Some victims were sexually assaulted. Others were mutilated. Yu even claimed to have cannibalized parts of several women, believing it would cleanse his spirit. He said he sometimes ate the livers of his victims, believing that that gave him strength. This detail was never conclusively proven, but was taken seriously by investigators, given the mutilation present on several victims. He said he planned to kill 100 people, that he was disappointed to be caught after 21. Yu's trial began in September 2004 at the Seoul Central District Court. The courtroom was packed with reporters, victims' families, and members of the public, desperate to understand how this had happened. He was charged with 20 counts of murder and numerous other offenses, including sexual assault, desecration of corpses, and obstruction of justice. Prosecutors called for the death penalty, citing the overwhelming evidence, the brutality of his crimes, and his complete lack of remorse. Yu first appeared in court on September 6, 2004. He apologized to the families of his victims, but maintained that he had no intention of stopping his murders. 2 weeks later, he lunged at three judges during proceedings. Yu was supposed to appear in court again on October 4th, but he had attempted to kill himself prior to the hearing. His legal team attempted an insanity plea, but court-appointed psychiatrists disagreed. They found Yu to be sane, capable of distinguishing right from wrong, and fully aware of the consequences of his actions. He had planned his crimes in detail. He had evaded capture for nearly a year. And most disturbingly, he had expressed satisfaction at having committed them. When asked if he had anything to say during sentencing, he told a judge, "Thank you for asking for the death penalty. That's what I want." On December 13, 2004, Yu Young-chul was sentenced to death. The judge described the murders as inhumane and unprecedented, calling Yu a danger to all of society. Following his sentencing, Yu was transferred to the Seoul Detention Center, where he remained until September 2024, when he was relocated to the Seoul Correction Center, which was equipped with an execution chamber. South Korea still has capital punishment on the books, but no executions have been carried out since 1997. In practice, Yu's death sentence became life in solitary confinement. Former guards have described Yu as quiet and compliant. He follows the rules, keeps to himself, but he has never expressed remorse. He reportedly told one corrections officer that he is haunted by the ghosts of his victims, claiming to see them in his cell. Whether this is genuine or a calculated performance remains unclear. He has been housed alongside other death row inmates, including serial killers Jong Do-young and Kang Ho-sun. Though still alive, Yu is, for all practical purposes, cut off from the world. The case of Yu Young-chul shocked South Korea, not just because of the body count, but because of what it revealed about poverty, about resentment, about a justice system that had failed to catch a killer for nearly a year despite numerous warnings. His case sparked widespread debate about the death penalty, about the need for social support systems, and about how people like Yu, angry, invisible, and driven by vengeance, can simply fall through the cracks. The media coverage at times bordered on sensational, but the families of victims never let the public forget the real people behind the headlines. For them, justice was never just a sentence. It was an answer to a question that no one should ever have to ask. Why my child? Why my parents? Why us? If you'd like to dive deeper into this case, check out the resources we've used for this episode in the show notes. Don't forget to follow us on social media for more updates on today's case. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and X. We also have a channel on YouTube where you can watch more content. If you enjoy what we do here at Evidence Locker, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now, and consider leaving us a 5-star review. This was the Evidence Locker. Thank you for listening.